once said that labor and capital are a marriage.
Yep.
And you can't have one without the other. And when you have a good marriage, the children is prosperity for everybody. And if you have a bad marriage, then nothing progresses. So I think that, again, while we, you and I support, I don't know if you did, you may not have been here when we supported the incentives for Ford to expand.
That was just before I got here. I was very happy to see that get done. I had hoped that we might have done some other things in the Kansas City, Northland a few years prior in the aviation defense industry, but that didn't happen, but at least the Ford plant did.
But we've supported business in trying to recruit other companies to come to Missouri. And I'll make the same statement. In our effort to be business friendly, we don't have to be anti-worker. They're not mutually exclusive.
Some would say in order to be business friendly, we have to be pro-worker.
I mean, I think that an educated workforce, a labor force that is professional, that follows through, that delivers a quality product, that consistently shows up to work on time, you want people on your job site who are going to hold themselves to the highest standards that are available. And you do that through professional organization and training. And that's another thing that's missed in here is a lot of the labor unions, not only do they act as bargaining units, but they also are they foster the growth of the individual through training programs, through assistance, and that creates the community, the labor community. And to be a part of that means that you're a part of a larger family that watches out for one another and that wants to build stronger, safer communities. And to be a part of an organization like that is good for everyone. And even though only 8% of our workforce are unionized, I guarantee you that 8% is part of the backbone that keeps our community strong. So you and I are here right now on this floor making sure that they show up to work every day to do their best. So we're here doing our job to try to protect their opportunities to continue to do their best. And that's why I'm passionate about making sure that anti-worker legislation doesn't advance. And it's not fun.
It can be.
It's not. Yeah. It's not because, you know what? I would rather be talking to the senator from the 23rd about things that we both enjoy and agree on and not standing up here keeping him from wherever else he needs to be. That's not fun. But it's our obligation for the things that we care about. And you have all those bills in front of you, and there have been a lot of bills that have passed. So I don't feel like our caucus has been unnecessarily obstructionist. I don't feel like we have stood up on every single bill and nitpicked every priority.
No.
It's just the ones that we feel are existential, that rise to the level that will be catastrophic to the people that we represent, that we have to arrive at the point that we're at right now.
Let me review what I have stood up on this year, all right? We're talking Tabor, all right? And I don't know that...
Yep.
I don't know that that was ever
going
anywhere.
You and I both stood up on that one.
Yep. Medical malpractice caps, and not for purposes of killing it, but for purposes of facilitating a resolution.
Negotiation, which I thought we got to a healthy conclusion.
Well.
One that I would support anyways.
Regardless, it is what it is, but we weren't trying to kill it. That's the point. I will say there is a certain other SJR that I've had a lot to say about that hasn't come back, and then I think like 72 hour and kind of this. And this actually maybe the first day we've had this on the floor this year.
We had a Senate bill I think earlier in the year, but not for very long. I think that it was up and down. We didn't run it like this.
I don't recall. Yeah.
I
But I will tell you, out of I don't know how many bills we've taken up. It has been hundreds. Yeah, I would say five or six that I've had a lot to say about. Most of the rest, I've tried to keep it constructive or just not wade in and slow things down. So.
And there are often times where you and I have spoken offline where we vehemently disagree with the bill, but it doesn't hit a point to where we need to feel like the engagement to this level.
I agree.
And we just vote no and move on. And a vast majority of the bills, I mean, if we, and a lot of times we vote yes.
Yeah.
And we support the agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will say I was very impressed. I think I was in the Senate for 2 months and maybe longer before I ever had to vote no on a bill.
Yeah,
it was a long time.
We moved quite a bit of legislation last year.
A lot of very good legislation last
year. We did. And just last week, we had a couple good bills. I supported the CBD bill. I thought that was a big step for this chamber and the state, and I was proud to see that happen. The same day, the Senate voted out an early childhood bill that I thought was, again, a good step. So there are things that we're doing that I can get behind and be proud of and go home and say that this is a very functional Senate, and it does do a good job at moving issues. It's just we can't stand down on those that we feel are going to be so detrimental that they're going to undo the way of life for the middle class.
Yep.
And I think that this is a step in a direction that will begin to undermine all of the progress that's been made to this point by men like Cesar Chavez and Samuel Gompers. So in a way, I read those two blurbs about those two gentlemen because we're preserving the legacy that was left behind for their courage.
Yep.
And we're saying that, look, we're not going to undo the progress that has been made on behalf of workers all across America.
And let's face it. I mean, you say it's not fun, and there is a certain physical demand of it. But, compared to their sacrifice, what we're doing pales. Absolutely pales.
I agree.
For their sacrifice. It's the very least we can do. To honor their sacrifice.
I agree. And I couldn't, have the fear of physical violent confrontation be a part of the dialogue. That to go to home every night and not knowing, how it was going to turn out. And of course, I have another small blurb on Jimmy Hoffa, who was a Teamster. And of course, it widely speculated that he was murdered. And no one ever found the remains. And so that's an example of a labor leader who actually didn't make it home on a given night. And
sure.
So,
I've appeared in front of his daughter in court. His daughter was a circuit judge in St. Louis County.
Didn't we meet a son over here? I think Treasurer Zweifel had brought him up. And Tim Meadows had
Tim's
had him
in town tonight, actually.
Is Tim in town?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good people.
Hanging out with
people.
A number of House Democrats, but I appeared in front of his daughter on a case, and it was one of those cases where the equities were all on my side, the law was all on the other side. But I will say, last year toward the very end of the medical malpractice debate, myself and the senator from the 10th were talking, and I mentioned that I'm kind of a summary judgment guy, and didn't get to go into detail about my summary judgment practice, but. That particular case that I was in front of her is actually something that I point to as a pretty good example of what I regard as a pretty good ability to avoid summary judgment, even in cases where it might be maybe possibly called for. It was a nursing home bedsheet case for some nursing homes in California, and there were a whole series of cases, but the way it works for these nursing home bed sheets, and again, this was all in California, but there's a choice of, there's a forum selection clause in the contract for St. Louis County, and so there we were in front of Judge Krantzer. And so they lease, this was a company that would lease sheets to the nursing home. The nursing home would actually rent the bed sheets. And the problem with it was, and there was like a laundering service and all that. The problem with it was that the lease term was for, I don't know, something like 12 months or 18 months or something like that. And what had happened at every one of these facilities was that the sheets had basically, they have a certain useful life. They get laundered frequently, which is a good thing, but they wear down. And these sheets had basically broken down, had not been replaced. And so you had a contract that basically
said... Even though they were rental units?
What's that?
Even though they were rental units?
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine that, right?
Yeah.
Who can imagine
totally
a rundown rental
units? I could see owning tattered sheets.
What's that?
I could see owning tattered sheets if you bought them and you owned them and after a period of time they became tattered. But if you're renting them, why not turn them in for a new set?
Well, but the point was the contract said they had to pay regardless of the fact that they had failed. And so we argued the doctrine of commercial frustration and failure of consideration, all that, which is all well and good, except for the contract had basically explicitly ruled all of that out. And so Judge Krantzer looked at my opposing counsel, who represented the leasing company, and said, you know, counselor, you have a problem on the equities here. And she looked at me, and I represented the California nursing homes that had been renting these sheets. And she said, counselor, you have a problem on the law. And pretty clear. And I, at that point, I was already far enough along in my career to appreciate it when a judge would basically say, you know, I'll decide this case if I need to, but it's going to be a whole lot better if your clients agree to what the resolution ought to be. And, you know, when I was first starting in the law practice, I will say, I didn't always appreciate it when a judge basically said, that's all very well and good. I understand your position. Now here's how you're going to settle this case. But the longer I have practiced, the more I appreciate, I appreciate it when judges do what they can within their power to try to cajole parties to resolve their disputes themselves, as opposed to have it be done by a judge or a jury, because even though that's what we have the system for, that's what judges and juries do.
Isn't that abdication of arbitration, though?
What's that?
Isn't that abdication of arbitration?
Well, no. I mean, no. All I would say is that much like here, we have different ways of resolving legislative issues. It's better when they are resolved bilaterally rather than unilaterally on both sides. And you know what? I would even say that about this. And this is important, all right? This is important. Because there was a form of this bill that left the Senate last year pretty early in the year. I mean, it was a long night, but there was a bill that made it out, made it through the process.
We all sat down on it.
Yeah, we sat down on it. And which is to say, I don't think we're being unilateral. And I will say this, too. Of course, the majority has means at their disposal to force a unilateral resolution. We haven't seen that yet either. So they're not being unilateral either. And all I would say is, you know, for folks that aren't sitting here holding the floor and continuing the debate, it might be a good time for an effort at bilateralism on this issue. But
Senator, that story about the sheets was just fascinating.
I bet it was to you.
For everybody listening, I'm sure they were just on the edge of their seats.
Riveting.
Riveted. You know who I feel really bad for?
Senator from Johnson, you'll observe the egress and ingress rules the Senate has established and is a longstanding tradition in the Missouri State Senate chambers. Senators, I'm sorry for the rude interruption. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. In the Game of Thrones, they name their swords, and the senator from the 31st or the 21st would name his sword the Rule Breaker.
That would be the sword for the senator
in the 21st.
Sometimes he's Rule Bender.
Rule Bender. He doesn't get caught a lot either. He will be back there tempting fate.
He didn't get caught earlier today. He introduced a class full of students, the floor leader among them, which I...
He makes me laugh out loud.
No, it never gets old. It really doesn't.
No, it really doesn't. You can never be too humorous on this floor to try to break up the monotony. But here's who I feel sorry for. These lovely ladies right here. We get breaks. We talk for 2 hours. We get to go off the floor and go to the restroom or get a drink. Then we come back. They're stuck. And all day, they have to listen to us drone on.
Say nothing of the doorman. They are
stuck. Nothing of the doorman.
They are stuck standing up.
Say nothing of the doorman.
They don't, yeah.
That's who I feel for. But
the staff that allows us to, that facilitates the process and their service to the state is invaluable. I don't know if any of them are members of collective bargaining units or public employee unions, but if they are, then we're talking about them here, too.
The senator from the 21st is assumed the dais.
He just took, apparently, the wrong route to get there. That can happen. Well, at least we don't have to worry about him getting gaveled down for the foreseeable several hours, possibly. We may have to worry about the podium lowering. Just a hair. Not very much. Not much.
Senator, so yes. We talked about Samuel Gompers, and we talked about the early labor movement. And one of the reasons why that labor movement was necessary was because of what's called the Gilded Age. How much do you know about the Gilded Age?
A certain amount.
Enough
to make it to Citizen B State Finals.
So let me give you just a little bit of structured information about the Gilded Age.
Sure.
Gilded Age, Mark Twain, born 1835, died 1910, coined the term the Gilded Age to refer to the period of American history between the end of the Civil War, 1865, and roughly 1900. The Gilded Age was characterized by massive immigration from abroad, ostentatious displays of wealth by the affluent, and rising tensions between rich and poor. The term was not intended as a compliment. Twain and other social critics used it to suggest that underneath the era's gaudy excess and superficial prosperity was a country in crisis. The industrialization of the United States, which had begun before the Civil War, rapidly intensified after the conflict. Within a few years, the rates of railroad and factory construction passed their pre-war levels, and the United States surpassed France and Great Britain as the world's leader in industrial production. At the same time, a wave of consolidation merged smaller companies into giant national conglomerates like Standard Oil. Consolidation made industries more efficient and generated enormous wealth for their owners. Corporate executives, the era's robber barons, like Cornelius Vanderbilt, collected paychecks so large they had no precedent in American history and used them to build lavish mansions in wealthy enclaves like Newport, Rhode Island. However, during this period, wages for workers stagnated or even declined, and widespread dissatisfaction with the economic system led to calls for reform. The labor movement gained steam during the Gilded Age in response to the low pay and long hours expected of American workers. Beginning in the 1880s, labor unrest spread to many major industries. The government, still under the sway of the laissez-faire philosophy of staying out of economic affairs in the marketplace, initially rebuffed calls to interfere with business during the Gilded Age. However, over time, the excesses of tycoons became too great to ignore. Starting in the 1880s, the government incrementally increased the regulation of major industries and moved to rein in the power of the robber barons. There are three additional facts. One, the phrase Gilded Age was derived from the play King John by William Shakespeare. To gild refined gold to paint the lily is wasteful and ridiculous excess. Two, Twain first used the phrase The Gilded Age, A Tale of Today, 1873, a book he co-wrote with Charles Dudley Warner that was one of his few literary collaborations. Three, industrialists welcomed the roughly 10 million immigrants who came to the United States during the last half of the 19th century, since the huge supply of labor meant they could keep wages low. Now, do you know the other book that, one of the other books that Mark Twain shadow wrote?
What's that?
Is that correct? He actually shadow wrote the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant.
Oh.
And what's interesting about that is Grant won some national awards for that book and is largely considered one of the best autobiographies of any president in our nation's history, and most people don't know that Samuel Clemens actually wrote the book.
Interesting. You know, there's a count that Twain prepared of his trip to the Middle East, and he apparently went to the Sea of Galilee when he was in the Middle East.
Have you been there?
I have not.
I have.
Have you really?
I have.
So when Twain came to the Sea of Galilee, he noted, and these are the words that he used, the Arab boatman charges $5 to cross the Sea of Galilee by boat. Small wonder Jesus decided to walk instead,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was appropriately Mark Twain. I big fan of his. I went to college in Northeast Missouri, not far from Hannibal. Was obviously just a tremendously influential writer in our day. Some would say he invented American comedy. But I'll also note that...
Well, he certainly invented the notion of the humorist.
Yes. I'll note that at that time in the 1890s and in what might be described the Gilded Age, you also had a rise in sort of dystopian writing, sort of the forerunner to some of what George Orwell would do later. But I just find it interesting that at times when you see a dramatic gulf in concentration of wealth, that you tend to see a pretty high correlation with dystopian thinking and literature and essays. It just seems to be an interesting correlation. And who knows? There are economists out there who would say that that sort of thing goes in cycles, and that the concentration that we see today is not what we've always seen, and that, you know, the economy will turn over, and just as a matter of economic forces, that it will right itself without necessarily making draconian policy interventions to make it happen. Who knows? We may find out. I mean, no more than Washington's gotten done for us any time in the last few years. But
do you believe that history repeats itself?
Well, I do.
It's bound to repeat itself?
I don't know about that. I would say that I think there is something to the economic cycle, and I think that there is something to generational cycles. I mean, both of those phenomena have been something that have been the subject of extensive literature and research. You know, from a matter of superstition, I don't know about that. Economies tend to go in cycles. Some would say that there are political cycles. I mean, interesting note. I mean, since World War II, we've been on basically an 8-year cycle at the national level in terms of who occupies the White House, with only one exception. Don't know if we'll see another exception in 2016 or not, but yeah. It has flipped every 8 years on the nose since starting in 1952.
The exception of George Bush.
With the exception of Reagan's defeat of Carter, had it been a perfect 8-year cycle, it would have been Reagan not being elected until 1984 rather than 1980. And he actually, I mean, a week out from that election, it was not clear that he was going to win. Now, on the other hand, in 76, I think Carter won by 36,000 or 60,000 votes in Ohio, and that was, you know, that was what decided the presidency. So it's not like Carter got in on a landslide, and that was, you know, on the back end of Watergate. But it's just interesting that there are some things that appear to be cyclical, and there's been a lot written, and frankly, about the generation that you and I are members of. We're Gen Xers, and there has been a lot written. We are the 13th generation since the first European explorers settled, you know, what is now the United States, and you know, they're looking back at other civilizations, all I will say is that the authors of at least one of the books I've read on that would suggest that the 13th generation has its work cut out for it.
Yeah.
One of the reasons you and I worked so hard to be involved.
Can you ponder being a member of the Virginia Company and loading up a ship in 1648 and sailing across a completely unknown ocean to settle a completely unknown land?
No, I can't. Although I will tell you, I had on my mother's side, there are people who were not too far after the first boat. I mean, within a decade of the Mayflower is when the first Putnam came over.
Well, Jamestown was our first settlement, and then the Mayflower and Plymouth Rock was a little bit after that. Do you think we're done? I mean, my kids, we went to Costa Rica for over spring break, and as we were flying to Costa Rica, my kids asked, are there any unknown tribes left in the world? And I you know, with Google Earth and our ability to kind of study the globe in a complete way, I really doubt it. I doubt that there are any unknown tribes left on the planet. Or at least that, maybe they don't know who we are, but I bet you our military who would study the geopolitical makeup of planet Earth would certainly know where settlements would be. And I just wonder if there's any more exploration. Certainly there's technological exploration, but if there's any more of that type, maybe the moon, maybe interstellar space travel at some point. But at this point, it seems like we've kind of plateaued. You know, we've hit a ceiling who knows what's in. Think about just 15 years ago, none of us had cell phones.
Yep, well, or very few of us anyway, yeah. Certainly not like what we have now.
Yeah, I mean,
do you remember all those, like, 10 suit?
Yeah. Maybe 20 years ago.
Well, maybe even longer. But yeah, I mean, do you remember all those, like, prepaid collect call? I mean, 10, 220. Hulk Hogan and Alf. I mean, there was just all of that went away when cell phones got to greater currency.
Have you seen the film Wolf of Wall Street by chance?
I have not.
DiCaprio. I watched it the other night, and just one of the things they told him that is, you know, it's a period piece of the late 80s, early 90s, and they said, get to a payphone. and there was payphones in the country club that he belonged to. And I saw that scene, and I was like, I don't even know if there are any payphones anymore. Can you recollect having seen a payphone in the last year?
Very few. There's one in the Deerbergs near us, and sure enough, wouldn't you know it, my son has just an absolute telephone fetish. Have no idea where that comes from. And
you're on yours quite a bit.
I've actually got the heck you say. I have on my phone a picture of my son on, like, yeah, maybe the last payphone in North America. I don't know.
Is it still 25 cents a call?
I didn't look. I wasn't exactly looking. You know, much like when he grabs my mobile phone, I'm not exactly trying to help him operate the thing. We're not quite there yet. But, you know, I just, one of my concerns about getting back to this bill, and I think the senator from the 5th has a good amendment here. One of my concerns about this bill is that we are pitting state worker and public employee against state worker and public employee. We are, in essence, picking winners and losers. And don't get me wrong, I'm glad that our first responders are carved out of the bill. I think it's important, and I will fight to keep our first responders out of this bill. And I will fight hard to do that. I just wish everybody else could be carved out of it as well. And this amendment, I think, talks about two particular departments. And I'd like to see us get those.
What's the amendment ended?
So I think we are on, well, it's 07S and 01F, which is the amendment to the amendment. So 07S is employees of the Department of Corrections, and then the amendment to the amendment adds Department of Mental Health. Now, I'm not sure what the Department of Transportation did wrong, what was sound cannons and whatnot that we've been talking about today, but we obviously have a number of great departments with great employees in them, and that's just at the state level. This bill, of course, implicates, going back to the amendment the Center for the Fifth had on the earlier version today, this bill implicates municipal employees, it implicates school district employees, fire district employees, the first responders are carved out. I'm actually not sure. I think we went into this last year when this was on the floor, myself and the senator from Phelps. I'm not sure that the definition of first responder here, it may carve out firefighters. I'm just not sure what it does like for the receptionist at the fire station or, you know, some of the other now I say that, and for all I know, there's no such animal, but I'm not sure that everybody in the firehouse is protected by this, and I'm not sure that everybody at the police station is protected by this either. It doesn't help the janitor at the police station.
Yeah, I was going to say, do they have maintenance or janitorial services that are separate employees?
You know, if they're employed by the department itself, that's one thing. If they subcontract out or lease employees, whatever, that might be different. But the bottom line is, it's great that we're protecting many first responders. I'm not sure that we protect everybody that is part of that community.
But listen to your language. We're protecting them.
Well,
they're
carved out.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I mean, why would we actively do ill or cause obstacles or hardship for anybody? I mean,
well, that's not a question for me. I agree with you. I oppose this bill. I just wish it was in a form that could allow us to move forward and take up something else.
Now, we've talked about last year when we passed this bill, it did not have a referendum clause.
Correct.
So that's an area where there's been a big change. And if we had last year's version, then maybe there would be a path forward where this debate might come to a conclusion.
Right.
Has anybody talked to anybody about that?
Not that I'm aware of. I've not been part of those conversations.
You know, I can't help it, but appreciate the senator from the 16th. I don't know if you and I serve on the health and veterans committee.
Yeah.
You know, he's a good chairman, and he's a funny.
Did
senator.
I just have my back turned to a head shaking no or something?
Oh yeah, no, he's got a silly face
from
time to time. but you know, I mean, I wish there was a path forward here like we had last year. We got to a place where, you know.
Well, let's face it. The reason why we're back again and the reason why we're here on a referendum clause, you know, there was some question based on what the bill passed out of the House last year whether there would be enough votes to override. I don't think there's much doubt of that at this point. I don't think there are the votes to override in the House. The reason there's a referendum clause on this is because the override wasn't carried in this body. This body did not override the veto. And so, Now the effort is to take it to the voters, and I get that. I mean, I don't have a problem. I'm one who frequently is reluctant to get in the way of the initiative petition process. I'm just concerned that we don't have the will to do it here in Jefferson City, and now we're just hoping to win an election to do it that way instead, or maybe just, you know, force a lot of people to engage in that fight instead of other fights, like who might be back in the House and Senate next year. I get that. That's how it works. But, the reality is there was not the political will to override the veto on this subject matter last year in this chamber. Don't think there was down the hall. And maybe the reason we've got a referendum clause is because that's the only answer that anybody possibly sees where this could potentially become law. And you know what? I think that when the people of Missouri are educated, I think it's pretty clear what their answer is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, the notion of what we're actually talking about here, which is the deduction of dues from an individual's paycheck, is just a convenience of technology. And this is what we talked about last year when we discussed this bill. I mean, we're basically denying the ability for a convenience to be done. You know, one of the things that we had talked about is this annual reoccurrence. I mean, if someone agrees one time that this is what they want to do, then why is there every year do we think that they've changed their mind? And if they have, there's remedies for them to do that. Why the additional burden?
Yeah. All right. Well, Senator, we've been conducting this inquiry for some time now. I understand that there may be some others who want to discuss this bill and or this.
Well, that's fine, because I was getting ready to do a small talk on the Panic of 1873.
Why don't we do that?
You want to do a talk on
the... I'm familiar with the Panic of 1873, but I'd love to hear more.
Okay. Because this is why I asked you if you thought that history is bound to repeat itself. Because listen to this. This is the Panic of 1873. One of the first global economic downturns, the Panic of 1873, started in Vienna, Austria, and spread to the United States several months later, where it sparked a five-year depression that ruined thousands of businesses, depressed wages, and sent the unemployment rate skyrocketing. The Panic of 1873 temporarily slowed the massive growth in manufacturing that had followed the end of the Civil War and greatly crippled the progress of Reconstruction in the South. In early 1873, the national economy showed few outward signs of vulnerability. Indeed, in the 8 years after the Civil War, tens of thousands of miles of railroad track had been constructed, thousands of factories opened, and the stock market surged upward. Even in the South, which bore the brunt of the devastation from the war, agriculture was on the rebound. Many of the railroads, however, were built with borrowed money. In June 1873, the Vienna Stock Exchange crashed. Turmoil in the European markets spread to the United States on September 18, 1873, when one of the biggest bankers for the American railroad industry, Jay Cook and Company, declared bankruptcy. Cook's bankruptcy was a major blow to the railroads, which lost their biggest source of cash. 89 of 364 American railroads would go bankrupt during the panic, and the railroad stocks lost a third of their overall value. For American workers, the Panic of 1873 was a crippling blow. Unemployment shot up to 14% of the labor force, and average wages declined sharply. While railroad stocks recovered by the end of the 1870s, it would be decades before wages would return to their pre-1873 levels. The Panic of 1873 also exposed the hapless incompetence of the administration of Ulysses S. Grant. Although a war hero and a military genius, Grant provided incapable to respond to the nation's sudden onset of economic woe. Indeed, in the view of some historians, the Grant administration may have exacerbated the panic by deflating the money supply, a policy that made credit relatively scarce and hastened bankruptcy for some firms. Three additional facts. One, at the time of the panic, Cook was hoping to finance a second transcontinental railroad to compete with the line opened in 1869. The Northern Pacific would not be completed until 1883. Two, the stock market crashed on September 19, 1873, the day after Cook declared bankruptcy, became known as Black Friday. Three, the average daily wage dropped from $1.46 in 1872 to $1.12 in 1879 before beginning to inch back up. Now, if I changed some of the words in there and I read that to say that this happened when Lehman Brothers crashed and the stock market went down, or we went back to 1929 and the stock market crashed and the Great Depression followed with unemployment rates of 20 to 25%, I ask you again, do you think history repeats itself?
You know, 80 years after 1929 gets you to just before 2009, like 2008, 2009.
Maybe. Yep.
80 years before World War II gets you back to the Civil War. 80 years before the Civil War gets you back to the Revolutionary War. 80 years from World War II gets you to about, what, a decade from now?
The every single time that we've seen this type of ebb and flow, this cyclical nature, we've seen concentrations, huge concentrations of wealth. We've seen consolidation of industry. We've seen prosperity in the hands of few not being distributed to the many. And the system cannot manage when it's so top-heavy that it falls over on top of itself. And that is what we've seen time and time again. And that's why Teddy Roosevelt is one of my patron saints when it comes to politics, because he busted the trusts. He broke up Standard Oil and Carnegie Steel and brought in the robber barons into his office and said, look, boys, I'm the President of the United States. You're not going to continue business as usual. And Rockefeller and Vanderbilt and a lot of the robber barons of the time thought that they were more powerful than the government. And Teddy Roosevelt was able to set the record straight and bring, you know, he called it a square deal. And he said, we're going to give a square deal to our workers. And he defended that desire to be a part of the middle class and the working class. And that was a watershed moment for the 19th century. The beginning of the 20th century, really, when Teddy was president, that created a boom in prosperity until the late 20s, when once again you had that consolidation start to occur. And today we have more wealth consolidated in the hands of few than we had since that time. And right now we're not saying that we're trying to make people not have capability of being wealthy. We're just saying, stop trying to take the middle class and the working class and squeeze them with anti-worker legislation. There's enough prosperity for all of us if we're willing to support our workers and give them education opportunities and invest in businesses to do things the right way. Costco is a perfect example of a company who does it the right way. Costco pays its employees well. People love getting entry jobs at Costco, because it's a place where they feel valued. And my family chooses to spend our dollar at Costco because of their business practices, because of their ethos, their company ethos, and the philosophy by which they come to the free market. So,
yeah, no, I agree. Well, I think there are some others that want to weigh in here.
Okay,
so
fair enough.
I'm going to give them that opportunity.
Yep.
But I appreciate your taking the time to inquire of me, Senator. As always, it is a pleasure, not our first late night inquiry on paycheck.
I'll bet it won't be our last.
Because
we might be back. We might be back in, what time is it now? I'd say it's 10 o'clock. We might be back.
You never know.
All right. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion. Senator from the 11th, for what purpose do you rise?
Mr. President, I'd like to inquire of the senator from the 13th.
Senator from the 13th. Senator from the 13th, do you yield?
Yes.
She does. Proceed.
Senator, there's been a lot of discussion about this.
There has been a lot of discussion about this tonight.
We are on the amendment, Senate Amendment 1 to Senate Amendment 1.
We are.
Senator from the 5th is asserting immediately after corrections the following, or Department of Mental Health. We were having that discussion, and right after, I was going to try to do an amendment to have it be part of corrections for everything, including county, city, and everything else. The senator from the 8th was in the dais and serving as president, and he gave the floor to the senator for the 5th, so she has an amendment on there too. I think it's probably pretty good to add corrections and the Department of Health together.
I think you're right.
So I think it's a pretty good amendment. And I'm glad that the senator from the 5th has introduced it. And I'm glad we got a real thorough explanation of the amendment from the senator from the third.
You know, Senator, I know this is directed at correction, that we're talking about corrections officers and mental health workers. Do you know how many employees there are in the state of Missouri, state workers?
I don't.
You know, these figures I have here, there's like 51,583.
Those are people that work for the state of Missouri?
They are people that work for the state of Missouri.
Okay.
It's pretty interesting numbers. I could even break them down for you by department, by gender. That, you know, we have somebody working overtime doing a lot of stats somewhere.
That's a lot of information. I didn't know. Well, how many work in the Department of Corrections?
Department of Corrections. Okay, I might have misspoke there. Oh, yeah, here it is, 10,842.
Okay. Do you know if majority of them or any of them are part of a public employee union?
I'm sure they are. I don't know. I have those numbers around here somewhere. I find it interesting, though, you know, I would think that that would be a pretty male-dominated workplace.
Yes.
It's not. I was really surprised.
I thought it would be.
Well, 59% of the workers are men, but 40.8% are women. I was really surprised at that number.
Huh.
I was surprised at a lot of these numbers here. With
did you see the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
No, and I was listening to NPR coming up here, and I missed. You know, every time that they were going to go to it, my phone would ring.
Well, Joel McHale, who's the who performed there, and he's the host of TV shows. He had a very funny but very sharp joke. I don't know what you think of this joke. He says that Hillary Clinton is running for president. She's one of the most qualified people ever. And the good news is if she becomes president, we can pay her 30% less because she's a woman.
Well, that might help balance the budget, won't it, Senator?
Well, it's a funny joke and unfortunately painfully true that women are paid 30% less than men. And it makes me wonder about some of the statistics that you have there. How that's affected, and really how, and I've heard you say this before, Senator, how being a member of a union, whether it be a public employee union or not, is really good for families and good for women particularly to get equal pay.
Yeah, it is, and I never really thought about what they call the glass ceiling until I got up in these chambers here to work. Uh-huh. And women had come and talked to me. But even in the sectors that we are talking about tonight, public employees, some of those women do face those challenges. And it's unfortunate that in this day and age, you know, the big deal in St. Louis right now is the former Anheuser-Busch employee that was suing for gender discrimination, that she said that she was being paid less than her male counterparts. And I haven't followed at all. But somebody made a comment the other day that they said, who's going to listen to her? She makes umpteen $100,000 a year. You know, and that might be, but it's all relative.
Right.
It isn't the amount of money she was making. It was the fact that if she was making, you know, $100,000 a year in her counterpart was making $125,000, or if she was making $30,000 a year and her counterpart was making $40,000.
Right.
That's the point, Senator.
That's the point. That's the exact point.
You know, because we are not families. We're not the, you know, for whatever it is, we are not the families that we were 60 years ago.
Right.
Or even 50 years ago. My mother stayed at home till my youngest brother started kindergarten. People are not fortunate like that anymore. There are a lot of people that are raising, men and women, raising kids on their own for one reason or another. So everybody should have the opportunity to get paid
right.
For the same services, to get paid the same, I think.
I agree. And that's what This amendment.
Senator, since you have three daughters, I'm glad to hear you
say daughters.
That.
Oh,
two daughters, that's right.
Oh, I don't know if I can handle three.
Oh, but yeah, once you have two, it doesn't matter. You could have two, you could have 30. I mean, trust me, I had
really?
Three. Some days it was like having 300. Other days it was like having one, and I wouldn't give up 1 second of it. And I have to qualify that because all three of them now I know are listening, so I have to be careful about what I say.
Well, we particularly had two. We had the one, and we had the other one so she could play with the other one, and we wanted to play man-on-man, too. We didn't want to have three against two, so we were very deliberate about that. So I think the senator from the 5th, I think she has some work to do on her amendment, so I'll end my inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further discussion. Seeing none, Senator from the 5th, you are recognized to close on your amendment.
Amendment to the amendment, correct?
Right. Amendment to the amendment.
Thank you. Mr. President, I close.
The senator from the 1st moves to pass Amendment Number 1 to Senate Amendment Number 1 for the Senate Substitute for House Bill 1617. A roll call has been requested, and a roll call has been granted. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Brown, Chappelle Nadal, Cunningham, Curls, Dempsey, Dixon, Emery, Holzman, Justice, Kevney, Kehoe, Krause, Lauger, Lamping, Lavoda, Leibler, Munslinger, Nasheed, Nieves, Parson, Pierce, Richard, Romine, Sater, Schaff, Schaefer, Schmidt, Sifton, Sylvie, Wallingford, Walsh, Wasson.
Senator from Franklin. Senator from Webster. Senator from Polk. Senator from the 8th. Senator from Nottoway. By your vote of 6-aye, 23-no, you have defeated the amendment to the amendment. We are now back on the underlying amendment. Discussion on Senate Amendment Number 1. Senator from the 11th, of what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. I have an amendment I'd like to offer.
Send your amendment
to the
forward.
Amendment.
Send your amendment forward.
It has not been distributed. I ask for a waiver of the reading and commit to you, Mr. President, I will not close until this amendment has been distributed.
Seeing no objection, the reading will be waived. You've moved for the adoption of the amendment. We will not close until it has been fully distributed. Senator, would you care to describe your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. President. The Senator from the 5th tried to do a good amendment to add the Department of Mental Health to corrections on this amendment. We talked about it. We thought about it. We pored over it. We really looked at the pros and cons of the amendment. The senator from the 3rd and the senator from the 7th talked about the implications of that amendment and how it would affect not only the people in this chamber, but the people of Missouri and perhaps the people of the world. But it looks as though the wisdom of the Senate said that maybe that's not the right amendment. So I now have the opportunity to have an amendment that clarifies the underlying amendment to make it far superior, Mr. President. An amendment whose time has come, quite frankly. And what that amendment does is it clarifies that we are not only going to opt out Department of Corrections, we're going to make sure that anyone who works in the corrections field, whether it be a county jail, a municipality, whatever it may be, will be opt out of having to follow this bill, similar to our first responders. And, Mr. President, I'm sure everybody in the chamber would agree, that first responders are important to our state, and they put their lives on the line on a daily basis, as do correction officers throughout the state. They are that line between those criminals that are in that prison and their ability to leave that prison. And Mr. President, I believe they should be exempted from this legislation along with the first responders. I feel strongly about that. I'm glad we got to this point. I think it's been worth the 7 hours that we've been here to bring us to this amendment, because this is what I really do feel like can put us over the top, to have us all in agreement on this bill. It's that good of an amendment. Perhaps, dare I say, the greatest amendment we've seen today. Mr. President, I'd like to inquire of the Senator from the 13th.
The Senator from the 11th moves the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1 to Senate Amendment Number 1. Senator from the 13th, do you yield to an inquiry?
I do.
She does. Proceed.
Senator, thanks for the inquiry. We were having a discussion about the workers of the state of Missouri. And this amendment that I have actually expands it to opt out not only the first responders, but also the corrections in the Department of Correction, as well as the local corrections. So how many people do we have working corrections? I think you told me that before.
Okay, state Department of Corrections, state of Missouri, and I don't know what this is, 2013 data. We have 10,842 workers in correction. 4,425 of those are women, and 6,411 of those are men. So if you do the math, that's 59.1% of them are men, and 40.8% of them are women.
That's I mentioned before, that's a little bit higher percentage than I thought would be for women. I guess we have female facilities where we would need those folks, and we also have other women who are doing maybe some of the other things.
Well, that is one of the few agencies in the state where there are more men than women. You know, most of our agencies are female dominated.
What about mental health? Senator from the 5th had that amendment.
Mental health.
Mental health. I just want to tell you, in a way, I'm glad it was defeated, which brings us to this amendment, even though I voted for it. But now we have this great amendment. But I'm wondering, what's mental health?
Mental health. There are 6,854 employees in mental health. That's of June of 2013. Senator, how many of those do you think are men?
I think about half, about 50%.
There you go thinking again. 4,879 of them are women. That's 71.2%.
Oh, boy, okay.
Yeah. 1,974 of them are men. That's 28.8%.
Okay.
That one kind of surprised me. You know what really surprises me? Labor and industrial relations.
I would think that'd be male-dominated.
Oh, yeah, it is, by 69%. So that, you know, only 31% of their workforce are men.
Well, I would think that former senator from Jefferson could try to bring a little more diversity to that department.
I think they have plenty of diversity, Senator. I like those numbers.
Oh, tell me those numbers again. Maybe I missed it.
Okay. 69% of the workers there are female.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
There you go. There you have
it. I saw it the other way around, but still.
Maybe in his short stint there, he's already brought diversity.
Yeah, maybe he's brought diversity, okay. But we do need diversity, you know.
You know, but you guys are winning in transportation. That's still a male-dominated division. 81% of those employees are men.
Okay.
You know, that's higher ed. There's another one that's heavily dominated. That's 83% females.
You don't have the total for all of state government, do you?
I have the total numbers. I only have the percentages broke down, for these departments. Yeah. And on here I have the legislature. Given our numbers here in this chamber, I'm really surprised at this. But I guess they're lumping both chambers together. 47.4% are women in the Missouri legislature. That's the elected officials and the employees. There's 252 employees.
Okay.
So that would include these dedicated women up here and the ones that work behind this wall and the women on the House side over there. Public Defender's Office, 58% female.
Okay.
Secretary of State, you have very progressive folks that come from your side of the state. What do you think the Secretary of State's office is?
Oh, I'd probably say, based on the other numbers, 65%.
You are very close.
Okay.
67.8% of the employees over at the SOS are female.
This is really telling. So predominantly of our workforce overall in the state of Missouri, I don't know if you're done with all those, but it's clearly women are...
No, I think we should be fair to the treasurer and the auditor. And those, too, are both heavily dominated. 56.5% of the folks that work for our state auditor are women.
Okay.
75% of the folks that work in Treasurer's Wifel's division are women. 75%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's those are great numbers, but they say one thing to me. Health and Senior Services, that's another one. 87% of those are women.
Yeah.
We did higher ed, elementary and secondary ed, 81%.
Wow.
That says one thing to me, that this bill or what we do in this chamber. You know, we talk about the labor unions, but I want to talk about my sisters.
Yes.
My sisters that this affects. Because this is who we are aiming this legislation at. We're aiming it at mothers that are trying to make a living. And, you know, if you look at these mental health workers, a lot of these that would be folks that work that are signatory or part of a bargaining unit, they are going to be direct care staff. And they are going to be people who are doing jobs that nobody else wants to do.
Right.
And they're going to be the people that get paid the least amount of money and right. work the longest hours.
That's right.
They're the people that work in our mental hospitals. They work in our HAB centers. They work in our veterans' homes. You know, and you go to think about the folks, the most vulnerable people in our state. Don't we want the people taking care of them to be taken care of?
Right.
You know, that takes a dedicated employee because there's a big turnover in that. But there are also some dedicated folks that work there for years. Mm-hmm. And they look at those people that they take care of as family members. They don't look at them. You know, I love the word when you walk into a place like that. These are our clients. You're not walking into a law firm.
Right.
They're not clients, they're people. They're people with disabilities that need somebody else to take care of them. Well, I'm sorry, Senator, am I getting off track? I know it's your inquiry.
No, I think you're on track because I think you're getting to the message of the underlying bill. How harmful that we ask all these folks to do a great job for us. And by the way, we pay them 50th in the nation in the way that we pay our state workers. I don't know if you remember the inquiry I had last week with the senator from Boone. The half good news is that in the budget, there is going to be a very small pay increase. But we're not doing enough. And then what we do is this body, or this General Assembly, does two things. First, it says, well, government's not working very well. Well, Senator, you only can get what you pay for sometimes. And we are getting a lot better than what we pay for. We are getting a lot better than what we pay for. We are lucky to have the dedicated folks that we have now based on what we pay for. But when you reduce that workforce and you don't pay folks enough, it becomes difficult to do their job. And then we wonder, why doesn't state government not work better? And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then, to add insult to injury, we have a bill like this that says, even though you're a member of a public employee union, we're going to say that you can't take out your dues, you have to check in with us every year and make it more difficult to be part of a group that's helping them protect their job and make their job better. Again, if we do this, Senator, we shouldn't have anyone stand up and say, gee, I wonder what is happening to our state employees. I wonder why they're leaving their jobs. I wonder why we can't get them more enthusiastic about their job. Because this is when you do things like this, it hurts the whole operation, and we don't run as effectively as we should. And I think it's so easy to have a bill like this and say, yeah, we're going to go after those darn public employee unions. We're just going to show them a thing or two. But you're doing it to real-life people, those women in the statistics that you talked about, real-life people who are trying to raise families, do their best, try to give back as best they can. And, you know, if they're working in the corrections, as my amendment deals with, they're dedicated, and that's a tough job. And we should reward. We should help. We should give them all the credit in the world. And if it means that it's easy for them to take their union dues out of their check, we should allow them to do it. It's that simple. This is real stuff that we're dealing with. It's not just a game, as I would think that this whole bill pretends like it is.
Well, you know, Senator, we talked about these numbers, okay? This is state employees, right? And I don't have the numbers. I'd like to know how many state employees we had 8 years ago. Okay, that would go back to your comment that we ask them to do more and more all the time. We ask them to do more and more with less.
Exactly. Well, you know, during the State of the State, the governor said there was 2,000 less state workers than when he became office. So what was that, 2005?
Mm-hmm.
So 6 years ago, right? I'm not adding up my math very well here. No, he came in office 2009, didn't he?
Yeah.
Wow. I've been in this building a long time. But so since 2009, we know there's 2,000 less. And you notice the that he says that. I've seen the governor say that in more than one State of the State to rounds of applause. And I'm not sure that is the right thing we should be doing. I mean, we should be looking at what's the right type of resources we need to effectively provide the services to our folks. And if it is 2,000 less, that's great. If it's 1,000 more, we should do that too.
Well, if we can say that we've become more efficient, great. But I don't know. I don't know what you hear from in your office. I hear from lots of folks that can't get through on their telephones to state agencies, that can't get anybody to pick up the phone. Well, it's not because they don't want to pick up the phone.
Uh-huh.
It's because they're busy.
Right.
Somebody had a joke about the 800 number, and you call and you call and you call, and then you get a recorder. And if you're insisted enough and you keep it up and you keep going, you might sometime get a real voice eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But
it just makes it more challenging to actually do the job that they're there to do.
It does.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the state workers. That's 51,583 people. Those are the state workers. But this bill does not affect only state workers.
Do you have more statistics?
I don't have more. I have some statistics, but the fact of the matter is, you know, the nurses that work in veterans' homes that are not,
right,
that don't work for the state, that might work, that might be organized at the VA, would this bill affect them?
Right. Absolutely.
Or nurses that work in any public hospital. Or we have exempted first responders, so we've exempted them. Does that exempt the people that work in the offices that might be organized, that, by the way, are usually women?
Right.
This affects...
Well, yeah,
you know, I had the utility, the public utility workers in there,
uh-huh,
and when I did that, I protected them. But what about the people that do their scheduling, that runs the offices? You know, there's a lot more of them in there too. They do all that kind of work. Your city clerk's offices, some of them are organized.
You know, in Jackson County, the prosecutors in Jackson County are organized under the Firefighters Union.
The prosecutors are?
It's kind of a unique thing. And then I think some of the prosecutor's office, I think the administration or administrative type folks are organized under the Carpenters Union. So I wonder in this bill, are the prosecutors considered first responders because they're part of a firefighter union, or they're not because they're not necessarily first responders? You know, that's going to be problematic on how you take those out. I think we're going to have a lot of people claim that they're first responders at some point, and that's the purpose of my amendment is to say that corrections need to be spelled out and they should be exempt from this penalty.
That's not unusual. I think you know, and I could be wrong on this, but I believe the IBEW might have employees that they may have employees and offices in schools, in some school districts that they represent. Communication workers, they represent a lot of these people. They have a lot of public service, public sector employees. The list just goes on and on and on.
And it's troubling that we're going after. And you know, maybe the biggest group, and I know you probably don't have the statistics on this, the biggest group that this is going to affect is teachers.
Yep.
I mean, there seems to be, in this building, and I guess through a petition initiative, somehow going after teachers as if it's a problem in our education system. I look back at the teachers I have, I look at the teachers that my kids have, I find them to be hardworking, dedicated, lack the resources really to do the job they want to do, but really are dedicated to the idea of helping these kids. And again, this is another way to go after those teachers that are simply there for their love of children and trying to develop them. My daughter, the one who's going to be in senior next year, her goal is to be an educator. And I hope that that type of enthusiasm, that type of belief that we need to help kids and that type of passion around it doesn't get squelched by things like this, doesn't get squelched by a petition initiative that says we need to get rid of teacher tenure because somehow the problems with our schools or the people who are there day in and day out. It's a ridiculous, it's almost comical if you think about it. But somehow along the way, there are segments of the society who believe it, and I don't understand why. I don't understand how you could interact at all with any teacher and then believe they're the reason that our education system isn't doing well. Or, let me rephrase that, the reason that we need to improve our education system. We need to improve because we need to improve. You know, we all need to improve. I think there was a bill, and I see the senator from Barton is here, and I think it was his bill, but he had this idea to give schools grades like we do our kids. You know, like this school would be an A, this school would be a B, and so forth. And I guess that would run to the teachers itself. And to me, it's a ridiculous idea to think that a teacher can somehow make up all the troubles of an area that maybe suffers from poverty, or maybe the lack of resources that we give them, or maybe the lack of training, or whatever that we give them, and then grade them as if they did good or bad for the world to see. I guess I would be okay with that type of proposal if we had some type of change to where legislators got a grade as well.
There you go.
And if you're not trying to fully fund the foundation formula, trying to do things to support, then you wouldn't get a very good grade. But we're part of the education system too. And as we look at how we fund things, we look at how we pass legislation to fix the transfer thing. I know you're passionate about fixing that. How we ever do this, we're part of the system too, and we can't later blame teachers for the ills of society. And we're talking about this because that's what this bill does. This bill does that. It simply, it says, you know, you are too organized, you're too focused on what's best for the school and for the kids, so we're going to try to make an extra hardship for you. We're going to make it difficult for you to have your employer pull the union dues out, and it's going to make these school districts who like doing that even add more difficulty in their own paperwork. And quite frankly, Senator, I think I would rather see our school board not have to come up, our school boards not have to come up with how are we going to do this every year and how are we going to have an extra hoop to jump through. I'd rather them focus on educating our kids as opposed to us having government get involved with this. And that's what this does.
You know, Senator, you bring up teachers. You rarely, you know, every time you hear somebody get up and stand up and talk about their successes, they thank their parents. You know, their parents had a big impact on their life. And usually you hear about an impact that their teacher, some teacher along the way, made on their life. And everybody, famous people all over the place, that's the first thing they say. I mean, I was reading an article the other day about a gal, her name is Simple Grandin. Have you ever heard of her? She is a woman on the autistic spectrum, born in 1947. Her high school and her junior high school life was horrible, to say the least, because she would repeat things. She had a great memory. She's very bright. She's actually she is a doctor of animal husbandry. She's got her doctor.
Oh, what's her? Do you remember her name, Ian?
Simple Grandin.
Okay. I think there was like a movie about her or something.
There's been movies about her. But she's one. She's, you know, she said she'd have never made it through those years without the help of dedicated teachers.
Now, do you, I mean, do you have a teacher like that?
Oh, yeah. That my eighth grade teacher. And, you know, when I got up here, by the time I got to... Actually, yeah, I had her in eighth grade. It was her first year at the grade school I went to. By the time I was in, let's see, in first grade, I was in three first grades, okay? So I went to school for first grade for part of the year in Florissant.
Okay.
Then we moved to California, and I went to the Golden Bear School out there for a while. I was out there.
Where in California?
I don't know.
Okay.
Was
too little?
6 years old.
You're like, California, okay.
But it was near Santa Claus's village. It was near, I'll think of it. But anyway.
The North Pole?
Huh?
The North Pole?
No, no. This is an amusement park, Senator.
Wait, is your granddaughter still listening?
Actually, the youngest one was listening about an hour ago, and she couldn't, or the oldest one.
Because Santa Claus lives at the North
Prudence,
Pole.
Prudence. And Prudence could not figure out, you know, she kept talking to the iPad, thinking that she could... that I would respond to her, and she was very confused that I wouldn't answer her.
Well, if they're still listening, Santa Claus lives at the North Pole. Anyway,
yeah, he
you're
does
saying,
live at the North Pole.
Right.
And they understand that. But I went to the Golden Bear School.
Okay.
Because it's very strong in my memory because I was at the beauty shop with my mom the day that President Kennedy was shot. And I can remember all the women just...
Yeah.
It was really horrible. And then... we moved back to St. Louis, and I went to school in Spanish Lake, which was near Florissant, but it was a different school. But I went to public school then until the fifth grade. And I went from the fifth grade to the sixth grade. I started in fifth grade at the Catholic school, and they were a little bit further ahead in math. So there was a lapse there where I really couldn't grasp the mathematics program. I struggled with it, and I was one of those kids that skated through. I mean, I'd get by the skin of my teeth. And in eighth grade, this nun came. Her name was Sister Gail. Well, she was young, and I come to find out years later, we were her first, like, principalship. And she gave me an understanding for mathematics. I don't know how. But it just started to click. And now I was not proficient by any means. In fact, in high school, the algebra teacher says, you're going to get through this, but please don't come back. It's no problem. Just get me out of here. Let me get my high school requirements. But Sister Gail made math. She made learning in general fun. And when I came up here, you know, I was a
terrible smoker.
Yes.
When I first came to the house, I was in my office and my LA came in and she says, there's a woman out here that wants to see you. And she said her name and it didn't even click. You know what? There is nothing more scarier than your eighth grade nun walking in without a habit while you're smoking a cigarette. I don't care how old you are. You have terrible flashbacks to your youth. You wish you would have never got caught. Because I was a kid in high school. I didn't really smoke. The one time I smoked it in high school, I got caught, and it's 2 weeks before graduation. I sweated for 2 weeks waiting for that nun to turn me in, and she never did. I ran into her again. She lived in Quincy, Illinois, at my sister's house at a barbecue, and here comes this nun. I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's Sister Marlene. What is she doing here? And all I could think of about, she's the one that let me go and didn't turn me in, because I would have never graduated then. That was a really big deal.
But you learned your lesson? Or no.
Of course I learned my lesson. I didn't even jaywalk after that.
Right.
You know, my parents, I'm sure, were very grateful for the education.
Sister Gail? Is that what
you... Mm-hmm.
So she came to your office in the Capitol?
Well, she lobbied. She lobbied with a bunch of different organizations. Now she runs, she's, I believe, president of Notre Dame High School in St. Louis. I believe that's her title. But at the time, she was working with MCU, Missouri Congregations United, I believe, and other social welfare groups. Yeah, and she came in and she would always, she wouldn't give me grief about it. She would just look at me. Well, I would make sure that none of that was going on when she came back. And she would go over and talk to the former senator from the 13th, too.
I bet he was quite the troublemaker.
Well, I don't know, because he is a bit younger than me, and I was long gone by the time he was over there. Because he went to a boys' prep school in his earlier years. And I think that his brothers might have had her. I don't know that he ever attended that school, but they had a relationship.
Well, I mean, to bring it back to this bill, Senator, the idea, and that was a parochial school, but the idea to try to make that teacher, who you still remember, who was inspirational to you, to make her job easier is something you would never want to do. And that's what we're doing in this bill. Now, my teacher, if I could tell you, and I found this a few years ago, and I think my mom found it for me. She had it saved. Third grade teacher, he wrote me a letter at the end of the year and said, thank you for being such a good in school. You're going to be a great politician someday. Please practice your penmanship. And that was Miss Minshaw. And that was, she saw a spark of something I wanted to do even when I was little and encourage you. And so the idea of trying to have a bill that makes it more difficult for someone like that to do their job just doesn't make sense to me, Senator. And that's what this bill does. And I think it's a shame that we do that. So I'm glad you agree, and I'll end the choir with you because, you know, I mentioned teachers. We mentioned first responders. My amendment, really good one. My amendment adds corrections. Employees working throughout the state, because we don't want them to do that either. Mr. President?
Senator from the 11th?
May I inquire the senator from 10th?
Senator from the 10th, do you yield?
I do.
She does. Proceed.
Senator, this is, I want to inquire you because this is a, well, this is...
Actually, can you wait just 1 second?
Yeah.
Mr. President?
Senator from the 11th has the floor.
Thank you for the inquiry.
Further discussion? Senator from the 10th, what purpose do you rise?
May I inquire of the Senator from the 11th?
Senator from the 11th, do you yield?
Yes.
He does. Proceed.
Senator, I saw a look of abject horror on the face of one of our colleagues when he realized he was getting ready to be trapped.
Yeah.
And not be able to leave his seat.
You know, the senator from Webster was like that for a bit, and hate to do that.
And so we were just procedurally trying to make it so that he could extricate himself without violating any Senate rules.
Well, This is your inquiry.
It is.
And I know why you inquired of me, Senator. As you are wrapping up your last session in the Senate, in the General Assembly, unless you run for House in the future, I guess, I know that you're curious to find out even more about this outstanding amendment. Because it's not necessarily the culmination of your career.
Sure.
But it really is kind of a big deal. You'll look back on your career, and you'll think about this well-written...
Is this amendment on my desk?
Senator, whether it's on your desk or not...
Oh, here it is.
Yes, it is. It's on your desk. It's one of the best...
Wait a minute.
...amendments.
Which amendment are we on?
It ends in .02F.
Is it handwritten?
It is handwritten in a very strong, good penmanship.
I recognize this penmanship.
Yes. And it says this. By striking employees of the Department of Corrections and inserting in lieu thereof the following correction employees working for the state or a political subdivision. Poetic. Quite inspiring. And I'm glad that you're inquiring me about this because, again, and I'm... spending some time and teasing about how good this is. But in truth, Senator, I think it's important if we're going to have exemptions to this bad bill, we should include all the folks around the state that work in corrections.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I heard you, and I believe was it the senator from the 13th, talking about tours that you'd had in correctional facilities in the state of Missouri?
Yes.
And I think we've seen firsthand, and then we've, of course, heard the stories. And we already know that these folks are underpaid, but we also know that they're doing work that is every bit as dangerous as a first responder. And I agree. I think that this is an excellent amendment.
Right. And if you think, if you're concerned about pulling those first responders out, because, well, let me ask you, Senator. I guess I could ask Senate carrier of this bill. But I don't know for sure if including first responders is helping the first responders or punishing their first responders. Because if it's such a great idea and these poor union people are getting their dues unnecessarily without their authorization every year, if what the proponents of this bill claim it is, that they're protecting these union workers, then why wouldn't they want to protect the first responders?
Oh, that's an interesting argument. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Or...
protecting those folks.
Or is it just what it really is, that it is going after these public employees, it is picking on them, it is unfair, it is not rewarding them for their work, and that... bad things shouldn't happen to the first responders.
So, either way, yeah.
I think the fact that the first responders are included is admitting what this bill is really all about politics and picking on the people who've done nothing but dedicated their time, their life into serving others, whether they're teachers or state employee workers.
And I think our state workers deserve more. I mean, these are folks that right now, as you and I are, you know, obviously a little bit later than we would normally be, there are folks across the state right now that this is their every night.
Right.
They are working at state mental hospitals. They are working at our Department of Corrections facilities. They are working out on our highways as we speak.
Now, you've dealt with this issue for the last – you've been in the Senate for – 30 years, 40 years, I always forget. How many years?
In the Senate?
Yeah.
I've been in the Senate for 8 years.
Okay,
Eight.
I'm not on the Appropriations Committee, so my math.
Well, you're new here. Well, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, Senator, I didn't put you on the Appropriations
Committee.
I understood that math was one of your lesser skills.
Very good, very good. That makes a lot of sense. So you've been, but you've been dealing with this issue for quite a while.
Yeah, I honestly can't remember how many years we've been on this specifically. I do remember I know, of course, last year. I feel like the year before as well. I can't remember if this is just the third year or if it's the fourth year. I just don't remember.
So almost half of the time that you've been here, you dealt with this issue.
Sure. Yeah.
How many people in the 10th district fit into these categories have called you and said, please get this passed? Meaning, how many members of public employee unions have called you or emailed, or I guess what these kids do is text nowadays, or they could have Twittered you, or they could have used their MySpace, or whatever, however they could have faxed you, I guess, since you have a nice fax machine. How many of them have contacted you and said, please get this done? This fact that they are taking, that my employer is taking my union dues out is really bad for me. How many of those people have contacted you?
Zero. None.
Zero.
Zero.
It's interesting.
Yeah. No. Now, on the flip side, how many have called, stopped by, emailed, written,
yeah,
and said, please don't let them do this?
Right.
Can't count. Don't have, I don't know. I don't
Can't
know anymore.
Count. That's
because
how
many
way
people,
too many.
Yes. Constant drumbeat. And frankly, this is interesting. This is something that transcends my two districts,
uh-huh,
the one that elected me and the one where I now represent. I probably get an equal number of folks from both of those districts contacting me saying, don't do this.
Two very diverse districts.
Very.
I mean, further away in the state they could hardly be. I guess they could be north-south, but they're completely east-west. Different, just a different mentality, but all of those folks are saying, don't do this.
Right.
Now, I've dealt with this issue. This is the second year in the Senate, and before when I was in the House, I don't know. But also, zero people who are members of the public employee union have come to me and said, please pass this bill so you can get us out. And do you know how many people have asked me not to support this?
How many?
I can't count that high. We already have,
well, your math,
we've already determined that my math skills are bad, but it's a high number.
It is.
And I think that's very, very telling of what this bill is all about. I did last year, if you remember, did get a lot of emails from a group called Americans for Prosperity.
Okay.
And they were emailing me, telling me how terrible I was because I was spending some time on this bill and I was against this bill.
Oh, okay.
I got about 13 or 14 emails. And probably, I don't know where they're on in my office, but maybe if I get a chance, I could read those again to them. But of those folks that were contacting me, 14 people. How many do you think were from my district?
So this is 13 or 14 people who contacted you from Americans for Prosperity?
Yes.
And they were frustrated or discouraged.
They disagreed with my position against this bill.
That you were speaking against this bill.
Yeah.
I suspect zero of those came from the 11th
district. That's right. Guess how many of those folks were members of public employee union?
I would suspect, this is just a guess, zero.
That's right. So why would American for Prosperity folks care so much about this?
I have no idea.
Well, we know. Because this is a purely political bill simply to go after groups they deem are against their political agenda.
Oh, okay.
And quite frankly, I mean, that's another thing. If some time, with you too, that probably needs to be noticed is that there's a belief in this bill and other bills that we need to go after union members. And I think the majority has that opinion because, and I really shouldn't speak for them, but I'm trying to understand where they're coming from. Trying to walk a mile in their moccasins, as it's been said. And I think what they're saying is that these unions are too powerful politically and we need to weaken them. But in truth, if you look at who some of these groups have supported politically, have contributed politically and everything, they are both majority and minority. You know that, right?
Sure, absolutely.
And so it's interesting how we would still believe that, the majority would still believe that they would have to go after some of these folks to weaken them, because they may just be weakening an organization that actually supports them.
That interesting.
Yeah, it really is a thing. And I'm afraid that sometimes we have, this idea comes from an outside group, or this idea from another state. I mean, we just passed a massive tax scheme that Kansas is almost going bankrupt in. We just did the same thing. We always hear these great ideas from around the country, and we bring them to Missouri only to harm, from a political point of view, the people of Missouri. And it's a real shame that we have that mentality. And that's why I'm so excited about my amendment to the amendment, because it really does help that problem, because it really takes some of those folks and I have to deal with
this issue. I think it does. And you know, Senator, I get a lot of folks kind of asking, you know, why do you care about this? You know, why are you even standing up here? I mean, you're a short timer. What do you care? You know, just kind of all that sort of thing. I mean, you've got all these other things that you're working on. Why would you, you know, blow political capital on this sort of thing? And I think that the answer is twofold. Number one, I do hear constantly from constituents, from members of these unions who say, don't let this happen
right.
to us. And so first, and I'm talking about constituents from my old district and my new district.
Uh-huh.
So that's first and foremost. But second, Senator, and I've been wanting to tell you this story for a while, and I haven't had a chance. I think this is something that I was possibly just born to do, and here's why. And I don't think I've had a chance to tell you this. But
I'll be glad to spend some time right now and listen to what you have to say.
So you know how when you're a state senator or state representative, you're asked on several occasions to go to schools and read books to kids?
Yes.
So I was reading one in at the Berkeley Child Care Center on the UMKC campus in Kansas City. And after I was done, the folks said, could you come back and meet our director of curriculum? And I said, sure, absolutely, I'd be happy to.
Was this named after former Mayor Dick Berkeley?
You know, I don't know, probably.
Okay.
But you know, who knows?
Yeah.
But so I go back there, and I'm not allowed to say my name on the floor, but she said, are you the same senator from the 10th? You know, she said my name, though.
Yeah.
That went to the Salvation Army Daycare Center on Truman Road in 1975.
Now, is that the one in the 11th district over there in Independence?
Yep.
Okay. I'm very familiar with that.
And I said, well, that's my name. I know that I went to the Salvation Army Daycare Center on Truman Road. And 1975 seems right. I would have been four.
Okay.
And I said, how did you know that? And she said, well, I was your I was your teacher. I was your preschool teacher.
Oh, wow.
And I said, how on earth could you remember this?
Yeah.
And she said, well, first of all, you have a unique name, and that was my first year teaching, and I just remember it. But she said, frankly, you were a pain in my rear end.
She oh, that
said,
was you then?
Yeah, so clearly it was me. And she didn't say rear end. She just used it all.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, I was four. How could I have been a pain in your rear end? And she said, well, one day, I was trying to feed grapes to the class, and you blocked me from entering the classroom and physically would not let me in the classroom because you were leading a grape boycott in protest of the migrant farm workers in Southern
oh,
California.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, get this. I'm 4 years old at
now,
this
do you remember
point.
This?
Not a minute. I don't remember any of it.
Okay.
And I looked at her and I said, I don't believe any of what you're saying. I said, there is no way that as a four-year-old, I knew that there was a grape boycott going on. There's no way that I would be blocking my teacher. And she said, no, you got to call your dad and ask him. It was a huge ordeal. We had to drag your mom and dad down to the daycare center because you were continuing this boycott. And I don't know, you're too young to remember this, but and I've since seen all of this, you know, after the fact. But most of the nuns in Kansas City at the time were driving around with bumper stickers that said, "Don't eat the grapes." And there were posters in solidarity to the workers in Southern California that said, "Don't eat the grapes." So there actually was a grape boycott going on, and somehow I soaked all this up.
Wow.
And so, I called my dad that night, and I said, "Dad, here's the story she told me." I said, "Is it true?" And he said, "Well, I remember it being lettuce, but yeah, it was true. You were doing this." And so I think that what I learned from that, Senator, was that just sometimes you're just born to do this.
Right.
You have no other choice. You're just going to stand up and you're going to fight for other people, especially those who are out there every day working to make sure that our society is functional and safe. And all of the things that you're doing here, that's exactly what we're doing right now.
Right.
And so I just...
Well, I appreciate that's a great story, because it really does go to what you're doing. And what is a little frustrating, well, it's very frustrating, is that we're not dealing with legislation where we're arguing over do we give teachers a 5% raise or a 10% raise. You know what I mean, Senator? I don't know if that's a good example, but we're not having any discussions about how we're going to help public employees do their job better.
Right.
All we're doing, if somehow people agree with our opinion of this bill and it doesn't go anywhere, they're still where they are. We're not advancing any. We're not having any discussions about advancing
right.
anybody, because this bill just simply picks on people. Picks on people. And I can tell you, if the proponents of this bill think they're picking on some big union boss or some big political organization, they're picking on, and the Center from the 13th gave the statistics, they're picking on women who are members of these public employee unions who are just trying
right.
to be dedicated to something important, like serving the other folks through working in either the state government or municipalities. Just trying to make ends meet with lack of resources because they're dedicated to it. We're just picking on them.
Right.
We just make it hard, their life that much harder. And, Senator, I'm glad that you have that fight in you, because that's what we should be doing. We should be thinking about how we can help those folks, not how to hurt them, so how to get in their way.
Right.
You know, it's not what we should be focused on. So that's why I wrote this amendment, to get us back to where we're focusing on the right things, and that's striking employees of the Department of Corrections and inserting in lieu thereof the following: correction employees working for the state or the political subdivision.
So direct corrections employees working for the state or a political subdivision, does that...
Three senators standing. Senator from Phelps, what purpose do you rise?
Mr. President, will you lay that bill on the informal calendar?
That bill will be placed on the informal calendar with the amendments pending. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you please refer House Committee Substitute for House Joint Resolution 90 with Senate Committee Substitute, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1371 with Senate Committee Substitute, House Bill 1865 with Senate Committee Substitute, and House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1075 to the Committee on Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight.
Those bills will be so referred.
And, Mr. President...
Senator from the 23rd. Proceed.
I'd like to make the motion to return the appointments to the governor. There's a list has been submitted. It is at
Senator,
the dais.
Did you make that in the form of a motion?
I think it's been distributed.
Okay. You've heard the motion of the senator from the 23rd. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you are recognized to close.
I close.
You've heard the motion of the senator from the 23rd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. You have passed that motion. Senator from Newton.
President, would you inquire the Secretary of three conferees be read? And if so, would the Secretary please read the message?
There are conferees. Madam Secretary, please read those conferees.
Conference Committee Appointments on Senate Committee Substitute, House Committee Substitute, House Bill Number 1439 as amended. Senators Nieves, Munslinger, Dixon, Justice, Holzman. Also, Conference Committee Appointments on Senate Substitute, Senate Committee Substitute, House Bill Number 1490 as amended. Senators Emery, Pierce, Lamping, Chappelle Nadal, Kevney.
Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, without objection, Senator, go to business announcements.
Announcements. Senator from Cole.
President, your hardworking committee on transportation and infrastructure will have a meeting tomorrow morning, Mr. President, at 8 a.m. sharp in the Senate Committee Hearing Room Number 1.
Announcements. The chair would like to make the announcement that the Joint Committee on Education will be meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30 in House Hearing Room Number 3 for the election of officers for the next year. Joint Committee on Education tomorrow morning, 8:30. Further announcements. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, no further business come to the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from Newton. All those in favor say aye. All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate is adjourned under the rules.
Yeah.
Dedicated to something important, like serving the other folks.